Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
The game is on the line, and I've only got a shot clock's worth of time to tell you about Subway's $6.99-foot-long deal. That's right. Order now in the Subway app and get any footlong on the menu for just $6.99. Fresh sliced deli meat, fresh crispy veggies. Ah, too much good stuff. Get it now on the Subway app. Any footlong for just $6.99. Use code 699FL now. Only here for a limited time. Redeemable at participating U.S. restaurants. Subway app, online orders only. Add-ons, additional plus tax. Additional fees apply on delivery. Excludes footlong snacks. Limited time.
Chapter 18 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 18. The Triumph of the King. The thing that men call presages, presentiments, and so forth, are, to my mind, for the most part, idle nothings. Sometimes it is only that probable events cast before them a natural shadow, which superstitious fancy twists into a heaven-sent warning. Oftener the same desire that gives conception works fulfilment, and the dreamer sees in the result of his own act and will a mysterious accomplishment, independent of his effort. Yet when I observe thus calmly and with good sense on the matter to the constable of Zenda, he shakes his head and answers, "But Rudolf Rassendyll knew from the first that he would come again to Strelsau and engage young Rupert point to point. Else why did he practice with the foils so as to be a better swordsman the second time than he was the first? Mayn't God do anything that Fritz von Tarlenheim can't understand? A pretty notion on my life." And he goes off grumbling. Well, be it inspiration or be it delusion, and the difference stands often on a hair's breadth, I am glad that Rudolf had it. For if a man once grows rusty, it is everything short of impossible to put the fine polish on his skill again. Mr. Rassendyll had strength, will, coolness, and of course courage. None would have availed had not his eye been in perfect familiarity with its work, and his hand obeyed it as readily as the bolt slips in a well-oiled groove. As the thing stood, the lithe agility and unmatched dash of young Rupert but just missed being too much for him. He was in deadly peril when the girl Rosa ran down to bring him aid. His practised skill was able to maintain his defence. He sought to do no more, but endured Rupert's fiery attack and wily feints in an almost motionless stillness. Almost, I say, for the slight turns of wrist that seem nothing are everything, and served here to keep his skin whole and his life in him. There was an instant. Rudolf saw it in his eyes and dwelt on it when he lightly painted the scene for me, when there dawned on Rupert of Hentzau the knowledge that he could not break down his enemy's guard. Surprise, chagrin, amusement, or something like it, seemed blended in his look. He could not make out how he was caught and checked in every effort, meeting, it seemed, a barrier of iron, impregnable in rest. His quick brain grasped the lesson in an instant. If his skill were not the greater, the victory would not be his, for his endurance was less. He was younger, and his frame was not so closely knit. Pleasure had taken its tithe from him. Perhaps a good cause goes for something. Even while he almost pressed Rudolf against the panel of the door, he seemed to know that his measure of success was full. But what the hand could not compass, the head might contrive. In quickly conceived strategy, he began to give pause in his attack. Nay, he retreated a step or two. No scruples hampered his devices, no code of honour limited the means he would employ. Backing before his opponent, he seemed to Rudolf to be faint-hearted. He was baffled, but seemed despairing. He was weary, but played a more complete fatigue. Rudolf advanced, pressing and attacking, only to meet a defence as perfect as his own. They were in the middle of the room now, close by the table. Rupert, as though he had eyes in the back of his head, skirted around, avoiding it by a narrow inch. His breathing was quick and distressed, gasp tumbling over gasp, but still his eye was alert and his hand unerring. He had but a few moments more effort left in him. It was enough if he could reach his goal and perpetrate the trick on which his mind, fertile in every base device, was set. For it was towards the mantelpiece that his retreat, seeming forced, in truth so deliberate, led him. There was the letter. There lay the revolvers. The time to think of risks was gone by. The time to boggle over what honour allowed or forbade had never come to Rupert of Hentzau. If he could not win by force and skill, he would win by guile and by treachery, to the test that he had himself invited. The revolvers lay on the mantelpiece. He meant to possess himself of one, if he could gain an instant in which to snatch it. The device that he adopted was nicely chosen. It was too late to call a rest or ask for breathing space. Mr. Rassendyll was not blind to the advantage he had won, and chivalry would have turned to folly had it allowed such indulgence. Rupert was hard by the mantelpiece now. The sweat was pouring from his face, and his breast seemed like to burst in the effort after breath. Yet he had enough strength for his purpose. He must have slackened his hold on his weapon, for when Rudolf's blade next struck it, it flew from his hand, twirled out of a nerveless grasp, and slid along the floor. Rupert stood disarmed, and Rudolf motionless. "Pick it up," said Mr. Rassendyll, never thinking there had been a trick.
"Aye, and you'll trust me while I do it.
You young fool, don't you know me yet?" And Rudolf, lowering his blade, rested its point on the floor, while with his left hand he indicated Rupert's weapon. Yet something warned him. It may be there came a look in Rupert's eyes, perhaps of scorn for his enemy's simplicity, perhaps of pure triumph in the graceless knavery. Rudolf stood waiting.
"You swear you won't touch me while I pick it up?" asked Rupert, shrinking back a little, and thereby getting an inch or two nearer the mantelpiece.
"You have my promise. Pick it up. I won't wait any longer."
"You won't kill me unarmed,"
cried Rupert, in alarmed, scandalised expostulation.
"No, but—"
The speech went unfinished, unless a sudden cry were its ending. And as he cried, Rudolf Rassendyll, dropping his sword on the ground, sprang forward, for Rupert's hand had shot out behind him and was on the butt of one of the revolvers. The whole trick flashed on Rudolf, and he sprang, flinging his long arms round Rupert, but Rupert had the revolver in his hand. In all likelihood, the two neither heard nor heeded, though it seemed to me that the creaks and groans of the old stairs were loud enough to wake the dead. For now Rosa had given the alarm, Bernenstein and I, or I and Bernenstein, for I was first and therefore may put myself first, had rushed up. Hard behind us came Rischenheim, and hot on his heels a score of fellows, pushing and shouldering and trampling. We in front had a fair start, and gained the stairs unimpeded. Rischenheim was caught in the ruck, and gulfed in the stormy, tossing group that struggled for the first footing on the steps. Yet soon they were after us, and we heard them reach the first landing as we sped up to the last. There was a confused din through all the house, and it seemed now to echo, muffled and vague, through the walls from the street without. I was conscious of it, although I paid no heed to anything but reaching the room where the king, where Rudolf, was. Now I was there, Bernenstein hanging to my heels. The door did not hold us a second. I was in, he after me. He slammed the door and set his back against it, just as the rush of feet flooded the highest flight of stairs, and at the moment a revolver shot rang, clear and loud. The lieutenant and I stood still, he against the door, I a pace further into the room. The sight we saw was enough to arrest us with its strange interest. The smoke of the shot was curling about, but neither man seemed wounded. The revolver was in Rupert's hand, and its muzzle smoked, but Rupert was jammed against the wall, just by the side of the mantelpiece. With one hand, Rudolf had pinned his left arm to the wainscoting, higher than his head. With the other, he held his right wrist. I drew slowly nearer. If Rudolf were unarmed,
I could fairly enforce a truce and put them on an equality. Yet, though Rudolf was unarmed, I did nothing. The sight of his face stopped me. He was very pale, and his lips were set, but it was his eyes that caught my gaze, for they were glad and merciless. I had never seen him look thus before. I turned from him to young Hentzau's face. Rupert's teeth were biting his under lip. The sweat dropped, and the veins swelled large and blue on his forehead. His eyes were set on Rudolf Rassendyll. Fascinated, I drew nearer. Then I saw what passed. Inch by inch, Rupert's arm curved, the elbow bent, the hand that had pointed almost straight from him and at Mr. Rassendyll pointed now away from both, towards the window. But its motion did not stop. It followed the line of a circle. Now it was on Rupert's arm. Still it moved, and quicker now, for the power of resistance grew less. Rupert was beaten. He felt it and knew it, and I read the knowledge in his eyes. I stepped up to Rudolf Rassendyll. He heard or felt me, and turned his eyes for an instant. I do not know what my face said, but he shook his head and turned back to Rupert. The revolver, held still in the man's own hand, was at his heart. The motion ceased. The point was reached. I looked again at Rupert. Now his face was easier. There was a slight smile on his lips. He flung back his comely head and rested thus against the wainscoting. His eyes asked a question of Rudolf Rassendyll. I turned my gaze to where the answer was to come, for Rudolf made none in words. By the swiftest of movements, he shifted his grasp from Rupert's wrist and pounced on his hand. Now his forefinger rested on Rupert's, and Rupert's was on the trigger. I am no soft heart, but I laid a hand on his shoulder. He took no heed. I dared do no more. Rupert glanced at me. I caught his look, but what could I say to him? Again my eyes were riveted on Rudolf's finger. Now it was crooked round Rupert's, seeming like a man who strangles another. I will not say more. He smiled to the last. His proud head, which had never bent for shame, did not bend for fear. There was a sudden tightening in the pressure of that crooked forefinger, a flash, a noise. He was held up against the wall for an instant by Rudolf's hand. When that was removed, he sank, a heap that looked all head and knees. But hot on the sound of the discharge came a shout and an oath from Bernenstein. He was hurled away from the door, and through it burst Rischenheim and the whole score after him. They were jostling one another and crying out to know what passed and where the king was. High over the voices, coming from the back of the throng, I heard the cry of the girl Rosa. But as soon as they were in the room, the same spell that had fastened Bernenstein and me to inactivity imposed its numbing power on them also. Only Rischenheim gave a sudden sob and ran forward to where his cousin lay. The rest stood staring. For a moment Rudolf eyed them. Then, without a word, he turned his back. He put out the right hand with which he had just killed Rupert of Hentzau, and took the letter from the mantelpiece. He glanced at the envelope, then he opened the letter. The handwriting banished any last doubt he had. He tore the letter across, and again in four pieces, and yet again in smaller fragments. Then he sprinkled the morsels of paper into the blaze of the fire. I believe that every eye in the room followed them and watched till they curled and crinkled into black, wafery ashes. Thus, at last, the Queen's letter was safe. When he had thus set the seal on his task, he turned round to us again. He paid no heed to Rischenheim, who was crouching down by the body of Rupert, but he looked at Bernenstein and me, and then at the people behind us. He waited a moment before he spoke. Then his utterance was not only calm, but also very slow, so that he seemed to be choosing his words carefully. "Gentlemen," said he, "a full account of this matter will be rendered by myself in due time. For the present, it must suffice to say that this gentleman who lies here dead sought an interview with me on private business. I came here to find him, desiring, as he professed to desire, privacy, and here he tried to kill me. The result of his attempt, you see." I bowed low. Bernenstein did the like, and all the rest followed our example.
"A full account shall be given," said Rudolf. "Now all leave me, except the Count of Tarlenheim and Lieutenant von Bernenstein." Most unwillingly, with gaping mouths and wonder-struck eyes, the throng filed out of the door. Rischenheim rose to his feet. "You stay, if you like," said Rudolf, and the Count knelt again by his kinsman. Seeing the rough bedsteads by the wall of the attic, I touched Rischenheim on the shoulder and pointed to one of them. Together we lifted Rupert of Hentzau. The revolver was still in his hand, but Bernenstein disengaged it from his grasp. Then Rischenheim and I laid him down, disposing his body decently, and spreading over it his riding cloak, still spotted with the mud gathered on his midnight expedition to the hunting lodge. His face looked much as before the shot was fired. In death, as in life, he was the handsomest fellow in all Ruritania. I wager that many tender hearts ached, and many bright eyes were dimmed for him when the news of his guilt and death went forth. There are ladies still in Strelsau who wear his trinkets in an ashamed devotion that cannot forget. Well, even I, who had every cause to hate and scorn him, set the hair smooth on his brow, while Rischenheim was sobbing like a child, and young Bernenstein rested his head on his arm as he leant on the mantelpiece, and would not look at the dead. Rudolf alone seemed not to heed him or think of him. His eyes had lost their unnatural look of joy, and were now calm and tranquil. He took his own revolver from the mantelpiece, and put it in his pocket, laying Rupert's neatly where his had been. Then he turned to me and said, "Come, let us go to the Queen and tell her that the letter is beyond reach of hurt." Moved by some impulse, I walked to the window and put my head out. I was seen from below, and a great shout greeted me. The crowd before the doors grew every moment. The people, flocking from all quarters, would soon multiply it 100-fold, for such news as had been carried from the attic by 20 wandering tongues spread like a forest fire. It would be through Strelsau in a few minutes, through the kingdom in an hour, through Europe in but little longer. Rupert was dead, and the letter was safe, but what were we to tell that great concourse concerning their king? A queer feeling of helpless perplexity came over me, and found vent in a foolish laugh. Bernenstein was by my side. He also looked out and turned again with an eager face. "You'll have a royal progress to your palace," said he to Rudolf Rassendyll. Mr. Rassendyll made no answer, but coming to me took my arm. We went out, leaving Rischenheim by the body. I did not think of him. Bernenstein probably thought that he would keep his pledge given to the Queen, for he followed us immediately and without demur. There was nobody outside the door. The house was very quiet, and the tumult from the street reached us only in a muffled roar. But when we came to the foot of the stairs, we found the two women. Mother Holf stood on the threshold of the kitchen, looking amazed and terrified. Rosa was clinging to her, but as soon as Rudolf came in sight, the girl sprang forward and flung herself on her knees before him, pouring out incoherent thanks to heaven for his safety. He bent down and spoke to her in a whisper. She looked up with a flush of pride on her face. He seemed to hesitate a moment. He glanced at his hands, but he wore no ring save that which the Queen had given him long ago. Then he disengaged his chain and took his gold watch from his pocket. Turning it over, he showed me the monogram, R.R. "Rudolphus Rex," he whispered with a whimsical smile, and pressed the watch into the girl's hand, saying, "Keep this to remind you of me." She laughed and sobbed as she caught it with one hand, while with the other she held his. "You must let go," he said gently. "I have much to do." I took her by the arm and induced her to rise. Rudolf, released, passed on to where the old woman stood. He spoke to her in a stern, distinct voice. "I don't know," he said, "how far you are a party to the plot that was hatched in your house. For the present, I am content not to know, for it is no pleasure to me to detect disloyalty, or to punish an old woman. But take care. The first word you speak, the first act you do against me, the king, will bring it certain and swift punishment.
If you trouble me, I won't spare you. In spite of traitors, I am still king in Strelsau." He paused, looking hard in her face. Her lip quivered, and her eyes fell. "Yes," he repeated, "I am king in Strelsau. Keep your hands out of mischief, and your tongue quiet." She made no answer. He passed on. I was following, but as I went by her, the old woman clutched my arm.
"In God's name, who is he?"
she whispered. "Are you mad?" I asked, lifting my brows. "Don't you know the king when he speaks to you? And you'd best remember what he said. He has servants who'll do his orders." She let me go and fell back a step. Young Bernenstein smiled at her. He at least found more pleasure than anxiety in our position. Thus, then, we left them, the old woman terrified, amazed, doubtful, the girl, with ruddy cheeks and shining eyes, clasping in her two hands the keepsake that the king himself had given her. Bernenstein had more presence of mind than I. He ran forward, got in front of both of us, and flung the door open. Then, bowing very low, he stood aside to let Rudolf pass. The street was full from end to end now, and a mighty shout of welcome rose from thousands of throats. Hats and handkerchiefs were waved in mad exultation and triumphant loyalty. The tidings of the king's escape had flashed through the city, and all were there to do him honour. They had seized some gentleman's landau and taken out the horses. The carriage stood now before the doors of the house. Rudolf had waited a moment on the threshold, lifting his hat once or twice. His face was perfectly calm, and I saw no trembling in his hands. In an instant, a dozen arms took gentle hold of him and impelled him forward. He mounted into the carriage. Bernenstein and I followed with bare heads, and sat on the back seat, facing him. The people were round as thick as bees, and it seemed as though we could not move without crushing somebody. Yet presently the wheels turned, and they began to drag us away at a slow walk. Rudolf kept raising his hat, bowing now to the right, now to left. But once, as he turned, his eyes met ours. In spite of what was behind and what was in front, we all three smiled.
"I wish they'd go a little quicker," said Rudolf in a whisper, as he conquered his smile and turned again to acknowledge the loyal greetings of his subjects.
But what did they know of any need for haste? They did not know what stood on the turn of the next few hours, nor the momentous question that pressed for instant decision. So far from hurrying, they lengthened our ride by many pauses. They kept us before the cathedral, while some ran and got the joy bells set ringing. We were stopped to receive improvised bouquets from the hands of pretty girls, and impetuous handshaking from enthusiastic loyalists. Through it all, Rudolf kept his composure, and seemed to play his part with native kingliness. I heard Bernenstein whisper, "By God, we must stick to it." At last we came in sight of the palace. Here also there was a great stir. Many officers and soldiers were about. I saw the Chancellor's carriage standing near the portico, and a dozen other handsome equipages were waiting till they could approach. Our human horses drew us slowly up to the entrance. Helsing was on the steps and ran down to the carriage, greeting the king with passionate fervour. The shouts of the crowd grew louder still. But suddenly a stillness fell on them. It lasted but an instant, and was the prelude to a deafening roar. I was looking at Rudolf, and saw his head turn suddenly, and his eyes grow bright. I looked where his eyes had gone. There, on the top step of the broad marble flight, stood the queen, pale as the marble itself, stretching out her hands towards Rudolf. The people had seen her. She it was whom this last rapturous cheer greeted. My wife stood close behind her, and farther back others of her ladies. Bernenstein and I sprang out. With a last salute to the people, Rudolf followed us. He walked up to the highest step but one, and there fell on one knee and kissed the queen's hand. I was by him, and when he looked up in her face, I heard him say, "All's well. He's dead, and the letter burnt." She raised him with her hand. Her lips moved, but it seemed as though she could find no words to speak. She put her arm through his, and thus they stood for an instant, fronting all Strelsau.
Again the cheers rang out, and young Bernenstein sprang forward, waving his helmet and crying like a man possessed, "God save the king!" I was carried away by his enthusiasm and followed his lead. All the people took up the cry with boundless fervour, and thus we all, high and low in Strelsau that afternoon, hailed Mr. Rassendyll for our king. There had been no such zeal since Henry the Lion came back from his wars 150 years ago. "And yet," observed old Helsing at my elbow, "agitators say there is no enthusiasm for the House of Elfberg." He took a pinch of snuff in scornful satisfaction. Young Bernenstein interrupted his cheering with a short laugh, but fell to his task again in a moment. I had recovered my senses by now, and stood panting, looking down on the crowd. It was growing dusk, and the faces became blurred into a white sea. Yet suddenly I seemed to discern one glaring up at me from the middle of the crowd, the pale face of a man with a bandage about his head. I caught Bernenstein's arm and whispered, "Bauer," pointing with my finger where the face was. But even as I pointed it was gone. Though it seemed impossible for a man to move in that press, yet it was gone. It had come like a cynic's warning across the scene of mock triumph, and went swiftly as it had come, leaving behind it a reminder of our peril. I felt suddenly sick at heart, and almost cried out to the people to have done with their silly shouting. At last we got away. The plea of fatigue met all visitors who made their way to the door and sought to offer their congratulations. It could not disperse the crowd that hung persistently and contentedly about, ringing us in the palace with a living fence. We still heard their jests and cheers when we were alone in the small saloon that opens on the gardens. My wife and I had come here at Rudolf's request. Bernenstein had assumed the duty of guarding the door. Evening was now falling fast, and it grew dark. The garden was quiet. The distant noise of the crowd threw its stillness into greater relief. Rudolf told us there the story of his struggle with Rupert of Hentzau in the attic of the old house, dwelling on it as lightly as he could. The queen stood by his chair. She would not let him rise. When he finished by telling how he had burnt her letter, she stooped suddenly and kissed him on the brow. Then she looked straight across at Helga, almost defiantly, but Helga ran to her and caught her in her arms. Rudolf Rassendyll sat with his head resting on his hand. He looked up once at the two women, then he caught my eye and beckoned me to come to him. I approached him, but for several moments he did not speak. Again he motioned to me, and resting my hand on the arm of his chair, I bent my head close down to his. He glanced again at the queen, seeming afraid that she would hear what he wished to say. "Fritz," he whispered at last, "as soon as it's fairly dark, I must get away. Bernenstein will come with me. You must stay here." "Where can you go?" "To the lodge. I must meet Sapt and arrange matters with him." I did not understand what plan he had in his head or what scheme he could contrive, but at the moment my mind was not directed to such matters. It was set on the sight before my eyes. "And the queen?" I whispered in answer to him. Low as my voice was, she heard it. She turned to us with a sudden startled movement, still holding Helga's hand. Her eyes searched our faces, and she knew in an instant of what we had been speaking. A little longer still she stood, gazing at us. Then suddenly she sprang forward and threw herself on her knees before Rudolf, her hands uplifted and resting on his shoulders. She forgot our presence and everything in the world, save her great dread of losing him again. "Not again, Rudolf, my darling, not again, Rudolf. I can't bear it again." Then she dropped her head on his knees and sobbed. He raised his hand and gently stroked the gleaming hair, but he did not look at her. He gazed out at the garden, which grew dark and dreary in the gathering gloom. His lips were tight set, and his face pale and drawn. I watched him for a moment. Then I drew my wife away, and we sat down at a table some way off. From outside still came the cheers and tumult of the joyful, excited crowd. Within there was no sound but the queen's stifled sobbing. Rudolf caressed her shining hair, and gazed into the night with sad, set eyes. She raised her head and looked into his face.
"You'll break my heart,"
she said. End of chapter 18. Chapter 19 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 19. For Our Love and Her Honour. Rupert of Hentzau was dead. That was the thought which, among all our perplexities, came back to me, carrying with it a wonderful relief. To those who have not learnt in fighting against him the height of his audacity and the reach of his designs, it may well seem incredible that his death should breed comfort at a moment when the future was still so dark and uncertain. Yet to me it was so great a thing that I could hardly bring myself to the conviction that we had done with him. True, he was dead, but could he not strike a blow at us, even from beyond the gulf? Such were the half-superstitious thoughts that forced their way into my mind as I stood looking out on the crowd which obstinately encircled the front of the palace. I was alone. Rudolf was with the Queen. My wife was resting. Bernenstein had sat down to a meal for which I could find no appetite. By an effort I freed myself from my fancies and tried to concentrate my brain on the facts of our position. We were ringed round with difficulties. To solve them was beyond my power, but I knew where my wish and longing lay. I had no desire to find means by which Rudolf Rassendyll should escape unknown from Strelsau, the king, although dead, be again in death the king, and the queen be left desolate on her mournful and solitary throne. It might be that a brain more astute than mine could bring all this to pass. My imagination would have none of it, but dwelt lovingly on the reign of him who was now king in Strelsau, declaring that to give the kingdom such a ruler would be a splendid fraud, and prove a stroke so bold as to defy detection. Against it stood only the suspicions of Mother Holf. Fear or money would close her lips, and the knowledge of Bauer. Bauer's mouth also could be shut, aye, and should be before we were many days older. My reverie led me far. I saw the future years unroll before me in the fair record of a great king's sovereignty. It seemed to me that by the violence and bloodshed we had passed through, fate, for once penitent, was but righting the mistake made when Rudolf was not born a king. For a long while I stood thus, musing and dreaming. I was roused by the sound of the door opening and closing. Turning, I saw the queen. She was alone, and came towards me with timid steps. She looked out for a moment on the square and the people, but drew back suddenly in apparent fear lest they should see her. Then she sat down and turned her face towards mine. I read in her eyes something of the conflict of emotions which possessed her. She seemed at once to deprecate my disapproval and ask my sympathy. She prayed me to be gentle to her fault and kind to her happiness. Self-reproach shadowed her joy, but the golden gleam of it strayed through. I looked eagerly at her. This would not have been her bearing had she come from a last farewell, for the radiance was there, however much dimmed by sorrow and by fearfulness. "Fritz," she began softly, "I am wicked, so wicked. Won't God punish me for my gladness?" I fear I paid little heed to her trouble, though I can understand it well enough now. "Gladness?" I cried in a low voice. "Then you've persuaded him?" She smiled at me for an instant. I mean, you've agreed," I stammered. Her eyes again sought mine, and she said in a whisper, "Some day, not now, oh, not now. Now would be too much, but some day, Fritz, if God will not deal too hardly with me, I shall be his, Fritz." I was intent on my vision, not on hers. I wanted him king. She did not care what he was, so that he was hers, so that he should not leave her. "He'll take the throne!" I cried triumphantly. "No, no, no, not the throne. He's going away."
"Going away?" I could not keep the dismay out of my voice.
"Yes, now, but not for ever. It will be long, oh, so long, but I can bear it, if I know that at last—"
She stopped, still looking up at me with eyes that implored pardon and sympathy. "I don't understand," said I bluntly, and I fear gruffly also.
"You were right," she said. "I did persuade him. He wanted to go away again as he went before. Ought I to have let him? Yes, yes. But I couldn't, Fritz. Hadn't I done enough? You don't know what I've endured, and I must endure more still, for he will go now, and the time will be very long. But at last we shall be together. There is pity in God. We shall be together at last."
"If he goes now, how can he come back?"
"He will not come back. I shall go to him. I shall give up the throne and go to him some day, when I can be spared from here, when I've done my work."
I was aghast at this shattering of my vision, yet I could not be hard to her. I said nothing, but took her hand and pressed it.
"You wanted him to be king?" she whispered.
"With all my heart, madam," said I.
"He wouldn't, Fritz. No, and I shouldn't dare to do that either."
I fell back on the practical difficulties.
"But how can he go?" I asked. "I don't know, but he knows. He has a plan."
We fell again into silence. Her eyes grew more calm and seemed to look forward in patient hope to the time when her happiness should come to her. I felt like a man suddenly robbed of the exaltation of wine and sunk to dull apathy. "I don't see how he can go," I said sullenly. She did not answer me. A moment later the door again opened. Rudolf came in, followed by Bernenstein. Both wore riding boots and cloaks. I saw on Bernenstein's face just such a look of disappointment as I knew must be on mine. Rudolf seemed calm and even happy. He walked straight up to the Queen. "The horses will be ready in a few minutes," he said gently. Then, turning to me, he asked, "You know what we are going to do, Fritz?"
"Not I, sire," I answered sulkily.
"Not I, sire,"
he repeated in a half-merry, half-sad mockery. Then he came between Bernenstein and me, and passed his arms through ours.
"You two villains," he said, "you two unscrupulous villains, here you are as rough as bears because I won't be a thief. Why have I killed young Rupert and left you rogues alive?"
I felt the friendly pressure of his hand on my arm. I could not answer him. With every word from his lips and every moment of his presence, my sorrow grew keener that he would not stay. Bernenstein looked across at me and shrugged his shoulders despairingly. Rudolf gave a little laugh.
"You won't forgive me for not being as great a rogue, won't you?" he asked.
Well, I found nothing to say, but I took my arm out of his and clasped his hand. He gripped mine hard.
"That's old Fritz," he said,
and he caught hold of Bernenstein's hand, which the lieutenant yielded with some reluctance.
"Now for the plan," said he.
"Bernenstein and I set out at once for the lodge, yes, publicly as we can. I shall ride right through the people there, showing myself to as many as will look at me, and letting it be known to everybody where I'm going. We shall get there quite early tomorrow, before it's light. Then we shall find, you know what, we shall find Sapt, too, and he'll put the finishing touches to our plan for us. Hullo, what's that?" There was a sudden fresh shouting from the large crowd that still lingered outside the palace. I ran to the window and saw a commotion in the midst of them. I flung the sash up. Then I heard a well-known, loud, strident voice.
"Make way, you rascals, make way!"
I turned round again, full of excitement. "It's Sapt himself," I said. "He's riding like mad through the crowd, and your servant's just behind him."
"My God, what's happened? Why have they left the lodge?" cried Bernenstein.
The Queen looked up in startled alarm, and rising to her feet came and passed her arm through Rudolf's. Thus we all stood, listening to the people good-naturedly cheering Sapt, whom they had recognised, and bantering James, whom they took for a servant of the constable's. The minutes seemed very long as we waited in utter perplexity, almost in consternation. The same thought was in the mind of all of us, silently imparted by one to another in the glances we exchanged. What could have brought them from their guard of the great secret, save its discovery? They would never have left their post while the fulfilment of their trust was possible. By some mishap, some unforeseen chance, the king's body must have been discovered. Then the king's death was known, and the news of it might at any moment astonish and bewilder the city. At last the door was flung open, and a servant announced the constable of Zenda. Zapt was covered with dust and mud, and James, who entered close on his heels, was in no better plight. Evidently they had ridden hard and furiously. Indeed, they were still panting. Zapt, with a most perfunctory bow to the Queen, came straight to where Rudolf stood.
"Is he dead?"
he asked, without preface.
"Yes, Rupert is dead," answered Mr. Rassendyll. "I killed him." "And the letter?"
"I burnt it."
"And Rischenheim?"
the Queen struck in. "The Count of Lutzau Rischenheim will say and do nothing against me," she said. Zapt lifted his brows a little.
"Well, and Bauer?"
he asked. "Bauer's at large," I answered.
"Eh, well, it's only Bauer," said the constable, seeming tolerably well pleased.
Then his eyes fell on Rudolf and Bernenstein. He stretched out his hand and pointed to their riding boots.
"Whither away so late at night?" he asked.
"First together to the lodge to find you, then I alone to the frontier," said Mr. Rassendyll.
"One thing at a time. The frontier will wait. What does your Majesty want with me at the lodge?"
"I want to contrive that I shall no longer be your Majesty," said Rudolf. Zapt flung himself into a chair and took off his gloves.
"Come, tell me what's happened today in Strelsau," he said.
We gave a short and hurried account. He listened with few signs of approval or disapproval, but I thought I saw a gleam in his eyes when I described how all the city had hailed Rudolf as its king, and the Queen received him as her husband before the eyes of all. Again the hope and vision, shattered by Rudolf's calm resolution, inspired me. Zapt said little, but he had the air of a man with some news in reserve. He seemed to be comparing what we told him with something already known to him but unknown to us. The little servant stood all the while in respectful stillness by the door, but I could see by a glance at his alert face that he followed the whole scene with keen attention. At the end of the story, Rudolf turned to Zapt.
"And your secret, is it safe?" he asked. "Aye, it's safe enough."
"Nobody has seen what you had to hide?"
"No, and nobody knows that the king is dead," answered Zapt.
"Then what brings you here?"
"Why, the same thing that was about to bring you to the lodge, the need of a meeting between yourself and me, sire."
"But the lodge, is it left unguarded?"
"The lodge is safe enough," said Colonel Zapt.
Unquestionably there was a secret, a new secret, hidden behind the curt words and brusque manner. I could restrain myself no longer, and sprang forward, saying, "What is it? Tell us, Constable." He looked at me, then glanced at Mr. Rassendyll.
"I should like to hear your plan first," he said to Rudolf. "How do you mean to account for your presence alive in the city today, when the king has lain dead in the shooting-box since last night?"
We drew close together as Rudolf began his answer. Zapt alone lay back in his chair. The Queen also had resumed her seat. She seemed to pay little heed to what we said. I think that she was still engrossed with the struggle and tumult in her own soul, the sin of which she accused herself, and the joy to which her whole being sprang in the greeting which would not be abashed, were at strife between themselves, but joined hands to exclude from her mind any other thought.
"In an hour I must be gone from here," began Rudolf.
"If you wish that, it's easy," observed Colonel Zapt.
"Come, Zapt, be reasonable," smiled Mr. Rassendyll. "Early tomorrow, we, you and I..."
"Oh, I also?"
asked the Colonel. "Yes, You, Bernenstein, and I will be at the lodge.
That's not impossible, though I have had nearly enough riding.
Rudolf fixed his eyes firmly on Sapt's. You see, he said, the king reaches his hunting lodge early in the morning.
I follow you, sire.
And what happens there, Sapt? Does he shoot himself accidentally?
Well, that happens sometimes.
Or does an assassin kill him?
Eh, but you've made the best assassin unavailable.
Even at this moment I could not help smiling at the old fellow's surly wit and Rudolf's amused tolerance of it. Or does his faithful attendant Herbert shoot him?
What? Make poor Herbert a murderer?
Oh, no, by accident, and then, in remorse, kill himself.
That's very pretty, but doctors have awkward views as to when a man can have shot himself.
My good constable, doctors have palms as well as ideas. If you fill the one, you supply the other.
I think, said Sapt, that both plans are good. Suppose we choose the latter. What then?
Why then, by tomorrow at midday the news flashes through Ruritania, yes, and through Europe, that the king, miraculously preserved today,
praise be to God,
interjected Colonel Sapt, and young Bernenstein laughed, has met a tragic end.
It will occasion great grief, said Sapt.
Meanwhile, I am safe over the frontier.
Ah, you're quite safe?
Absolutely. And in the afternoon of tomorrow, you and Bernenstein will set out for Strelsau, bringing with you the body of the king. And Rudolf, after a pause, whispered, you must shave his face. And if the doctors want to talk about how long he's been dead, why, they have, as I say, palms. Sapt sat silently for a while, apparently considering the scheme. It was risky enough, in all conscience, but success had made Rudolf bold, and he had learned how slow suspicion is, if a deception be bold enough. It is only likely frauds that are detected. "Well, what do you say?" asked Mr. Rassendyll. I observed that he said nothing to Sapt of what the Queen and he had determined to do afterwards. Sapt wrinkled his forehead. I saw him glance at James, and the slightest, briefest smile showed on James's face. "It's dangerous, of course," pursued Rudolf, "but I believe that when they see the king's body..."
"That's the point," interrupted Sapt. "They can't see the king's body."
Rudolf looked at him with some surprise. Then, speaking in a low voice, lest the queen should hear and be distressed, he went on, "You must prepare it, you know. Bring it here in a shell. Only a few officials need see the face." Sapt rose to his feet and stood facing Mr. Rassendyll.
"The plan's a pretty one, but it breaks down at one point,"
said he, in a strange voice, even harsher than his was wont to be. I was on fire with excitement, for I would have staked my life now that he had some strange tidings for us.
"There is nobody," said he.
Even Mr. Rassendyll's composure gave way. He sprang forward, catching Sapt by the arm. "Nobody? What do you mean?" he exclaimed. Sapt cast another glance at James, and then began in an even, mechanical voice, as though he were reading a lesson he had learnt, or playing a part that habit made familiar.
"That poor fellow Herbert carelessly left a candle burning where the oil and the wood were kept," he said. "This afternoon, about 6, James and I lay down for a nap after our meal. At about 7, James came to my side and roused me. My room was full of smoke. The lodge was ablaze. I darted out of bed. The fire had made too much headway. We could not hope to quench it. We had but one thought."
He suddenly paused and looked at James. "But one thought, to save our companion," said James gravely.
"But one thought, to save our companion. We rushed to the door of the room where he was. I opened the door and tried to enter. It was certain death. James tried but fell back. Again I rushed in. James pulled me back. It was but another death. We had to save ourselves. We gained the open air. The lodge was a sheet of flame. We could do nothing but stand watching till the swiftly burning wood blackened to ashes and the flames died down. As we watched, we knew that all in the cottage must be dead. What could we do? At last James started off in the hope of getting help. He found a party of charcoal burners, and they came with him. The flames were burnt down now, and we and they approached the charred ruins. Everything was in ashes, but...
He lowered his voice.
We found what seemed to be the body of Boris the Hound. In another room was a charred corpse, whose hunting horn, melted to a molten mass, told us that it had been Herbert the Forester. And there was another corpse, almost shapeless, utterly unrecognisable. We saw it. The charcoal burners saw it. Then more peasants came round, drawn by the sight of the flames. None could tell who it was. Only I and James knew. And we mounted our horses and have ridden here to tell the king.
Sapt finished his lesson or his story. A sob burst from the queen, and she hid her face in her hands. Bernenstein and I, amazed at this strange tale, scarcely understanding whether it were jest or earnest, stood staring stupidly at Sapt. Then I, overcome by the strange thing, turned half foolish by the bizarre mingling of comedy and impressiveness in Sapt's rendering of it, plucked him by the sleeve, and asked, with something between a laugh and a gasp, "Who had that other corpse been, Constable?" He turned his small, keen eyes on me, in persistent gravity and unflinching effrontery.
"Mr. Rassendyll, a friend of the King's, who, with his servant James, was awaiting His Majesty's return from Strelsau. His servant here is ready to start for England, to tell Mr. Rassendyll's relatives the news."
The Queen had begun to listen before now. Her eyes were fixed on Sapt, and she had stretched out one arm to him, as if imploring him to read her his riddle. But a few words had in truth declared his device plainly enough in all its simplicity. Rudolf Rassendyll was dead, his body burnt to a cinder, and the king was alive, whole, and on his throne in Strelsau. Thus had Sapt caught from James, the servant, the infection of his madness, and had fulfilled in action the strange imagination which the little man had unfolded to him in order to pass their idle hours at the lodge. Suddenly Mr. Rassendyll spoke in clear, short tones. "This is all a lie, Sapt," said he, and his lips curled in contemptuous amusement.
"It's no lie that the lodge is burnt, and the body's in it, and that half a hundred of the peasants know it, and that no man could tell the body for the king's. As for the rest, it is a lie, but I think the truth in it is enough to serve."
The two men stood facing one another with defiant eyes. Rudolf had caught the meaning of the great and audacious trick which Sapt and his companion had played. It was impossible now to bring the king's body to Strelsau. It seemed no less impossible to declare that the man burnt in the lodge was the king. Thus Sapt had forced Rudolf's hand. He had been inspired by the same vision as we, and endowed with more unshrinking boldness. But when I saw how Rudolf looked at him, I did not know but that they would go from the Queen's presence, set on a deadly quarrel. Mr. Rassendyll, however, mastered his temper. "You're all bent on having me a rascal," he said coldly. "Fritz and Bernenstein here urge me. You, Sapt, try to force me. James there is in the plot, for all I know." "I suggested it, sir," said James, not defiantly or with disrespect, but as if in simple, dutiful obedience to his master's implied question. "As I thought, all of you. Well, I won't be forced. I see now that there's no way out of this affair save one. That one I'll follow." We none of us spoke, but waited till he should be pleased to continue. "Of the Queen's letter I need say nothing and will say nothing," he pursued, "but I will tell them that I'm not the king but Rudolf Rassendyll, and that I played the king only in order to serve the queen and punish Rupert of Hentzau. That will serve, and it will cut this net of Sapt's from about my limbs." He spoke firmly and coldly, so that when I looked at him, I was amazed to see how his lips twitched and that his forehead was moist with sweat. Then I understood what a sudden, swift, and fearful struggle he had suffered, and how the great temptation had wrung and tortured him before he, victorious, had set the thing behind him. I went to him and clasped his hand.
This action of mine seemed to soften him. "Sapt, Sapt," he said, "you almost made a rogue of me." Sapt did not respond to his gentler mood. He had been pacing angrily up and down the room. Now he stopped abruptly before Rudolf and pointed with his finger at the Queen.
"I make a rogue of you?" he exclaimed. "And what do you make of our Queen, whom we all serve? What does this truth you'll tell make of her? Haven't I heard how she greeted you before all Strelsau as her husband and her love? Will they believe that she didn't know her husband? Ah, you may show yourself. You may say they didn't know you. Will they believe she didn't? Was the King's ring on your finger? Where is it? And how comes Mr. Rassendyll to be at Fritz von Tarlenheim's for hours with the Queen when the King is at his hunting lodge? The King has died already, and two men besides, to save a word against her. And you, you'll be the man to set every tongue in Strelsau talking, and every finger pointing in suspicion at her?" Rudolf made no answer. When Sapt had first uttered the Queen's name, he had drawn near and let his hand fall over the back of her chair. She put hers up to meet it, and so they remained. But I saw that Rudolf's face had gone very pale. "And we, your friends," pursued Sapt, "for we've stood by you as we've stood by the Queen, by God we have, Fritz and young Bernenstein here and I. If this truth's told, who'll believe that we were loyal to the King, that we didn't know, that we weren't accomplices in the tricking of the King, maybe in his murder? Ah, Rudolf Rassendyll, God preserve me from a conscience that won't let me be true to the woman I love or the friends who love me."
I had never seen the old fellow so moved. He carried me with him, as he carried Bernenstein. I know now that we were too ready to be convinced, rather that, borne along by our passionate desire, we needed no convincing at all. His excited appeal seemed to us an argument. At least the danger to the Queen on which he dwelt was real and true and great. Then a sudden change came over him. He caught Rudolf's hand and spoke to him again in a low, broken voice, an unwanted softness transforming his harsh tones.
"Lad," he said, "don't say no. Here's the finest lady alive, sick for her lover, and the finest country in the world, sick for its true king, and the best friends, aye, by heaven, the best friends man ever had, sick to call you master. I know nothing about your conscience, but this I know, the King's dead, and the place is empty, and I don't see what Almighty God sent you here for, unless it was to fill it. Come, lad, for our love and her honour. While he was alive, I'd have killed you sooner than let you take it. He is dead. Now, for our love and her honour, lad."
I do not know what thoughts passed in Mr. Rassendyll's mind. His face was set and rigid. He made no sign when Sapt finished, but stood as he was, motionless, for a long while. Then he slowly bent his head and looked down into the Queen's eyes. For a while she sat looking back into his. Then, carried away by the wild hope of immediate joy, and by her love for him and her pride in the place he was offered, she sprang up and threw herself at his feet, crying, "Yes, yes, for my sake, Rudolf, for my sake!" "Are you two against me, my queen?" he murmured, caressing her ruddy hair. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 20. The Decision of Heaven. We were half mad that night, Sapt and Bernenstein and I. The thing seemed to have got into our blood, and to have become part of ourselves.
For us it was inevitable. Nay, it was done. Sapt busied himself in preparing the account of the fire at the hunting lodge. It was to be communicated to the journals, and it told with much circumstantiality how Rudolf Rassendyll had come to visit the king with James his servant, and the king, being summoned unexpectedly to the capital, had been awaiting his majesty's return when he met his fate. There was a short history of Rudolf, a glancing reference to his family, a dignified expression of condolence with his relatives, to whom the king was sending messages of deepest regret by the hands of Mr. Rassendyll's servant. At another table, young Bernenstein was drawing up, under the constable's direction, a narrative of Rupert of Hentzau's attempt on the king's life, and the king's courage in defending himself. The count, eager to return, so it ran, had persuaded the king to meet him by declaring that he held a state document of great importance and of a most secret nature. The king, with his habitual fearlessness, had gone alone, but only to refuse with scorn Count Rupert's terms. Enraged at this unfavourable reception, the audacious criminal had made a sudden attack on the king, with what issue all knew. He had met his own death, while the king, perceiving from a glance at the document that it compromised well-known persons, had, with the nobility which marked him, destroyed it, unread, before the eyes of those who were rushing in to his rescue. I supplied suggestions and improvements, and, engrossed in contriving how to blind curious eyes, we forgot the real and permanent difficulties of the thing we had resolved upon. For us they did not exist. Sapt met every objection by declaring that the thing had been done once and could be done again. Bernenstein and I were not behind him in confidence. We would guard the secret with brain and hand and life, even as we had guarded and kept the secret of the Queen's letter, which would now go with Rupert of Hentzau to his grave. Bauer we could catch and silence. Nay, who would listen to such a tale from such a man? Rischenheim was ours. The old woman would keep her doubts between her teeth for her own sake. To his own land and his own people, Rudolf must be dead, while the king of Ruritania would stand before all Europe, recognised, unquestioned, unassailed. True, he must marry the queen again. Sapt was ready with the means, and would hear nothing of the difficulty and risk in finding a hand to perform the necessary ceremony. If we quailed in our courage, we had but to look at the alternative, and find recompense for the perils of what we meant to undertake, by a consideration of the desperate risk involved in abandoning it. Persuaded that the substitution of Rudolf for the king was the only thing that would serve our turn, we asked no longer whether it were possible, but sought only the means to make it safe, and more safe. But Rudolf himself had not spoken. Sapt's appeal and the Queen's imploring cry had shaken, but not overcome him. He had wavered, but he was not won. Yet there was no talk of impossibility or peril in his mouth, any more than in ours. Those were not what gave him pause. The score on which he hesitated was whether the thing should be done, not whether it could. Our appeals were not to brace a failing courage, but to cajole a sturdy sense of honour, which found the imposture distasteful, so soon as it seemed to serve a personal end. To serve the king, he had played the king in old days, but he did not love to play the king when the profit of it was to be his own. Hence he was unmoved till his care for the fair fame of the queen and the love of his friends joined to buffet his resolution. Then he faltered, but he had not fallen. Yet Colonel Sapt did all as though he had given his assent, and watched the last hours in which his flight from Strelsau were possible go quickly by with more than equanimity. Why hurry Rudolf's resolve? Every moment shut him closer in the trap of an inevitable choice. With every hour that he was called the king, it became more impossible for him to bear any other name all his days. Therefore Sapt let Mr. Rassendyll doubt and struggle, while he himself wrote his story and laid his long-headed plans. And now and then James, the little servant, came in and went out, sedate and smug, but with a quiet satisfaction gleaming in his eyes. He had made a story for a pastime, and it was being translated into history. He at least would bear his part in it unflinchingly. Before now, the Queen had left us, persuaded to lie down and try to rest till the matter should be settled. Stilled by Rudolf's gentle rebuke, she had urged him no more in words, but there was an entreaty in her eyes stronger than any spoken prayer, and a piteousness in the lingering of her hand in his harder to resist than 10,000 sad petitions. At last he had led her from the room and commended her to Helga's care. Then, returning to us, he stood silent a little while. We also were silent, Sapt sitting and looking up at him, with his brows knit and his teeth restlessly chewing the moustache on his lip.
"Well, lad,"
he said at last, briefly putting the great question. Rudolf walked to the window and seemed to lose himself for a moment in the contemplation of the quiet night. There were no more than a few stragglers in the street now. The moon shone white and clear on the empty square. "I should like to walk up and down outside and think it over," he said, turning to us. And as Bernenstein sprang up to accompany him, he added, "No, alone."
"Yes, do,"
said old Sapt, with a glance at the clock, whose hands were now hard on 2 o'clock.
"Take your time, lad, take your time."
Rudolf looked at him and broke into a smile. "I'm not your dupe, old Sapt," said he, shaking his head. "Trust me, if I decide to get away, I'll get away, be it what o'clock it will."
"Yes, confound you," grinned Colonel Sapt.
So he left us, and then came that long time of scheming and planning and most persistent eye-shutting, in which occupations an hour wore its life away. Rudolf had not passed out of the porch, and we supposed that he had betaken himself to the gardens, there to fight his battle. Old Sapt, having done his work, suddenly turned talkative.
"That moon there," he said, pointing his square, thick forefinger at the window, "is a mighty untrustworthy lady. I've known her wake a villain's conscience before now."
"I've known her to send the lovers to sleep," laughed young Bernenstein, rising from his table, stretching himself and lighting a cigar.
"Aye, she's apt to take a man out of what he is," pursued old Sapt. "Set a quiet man near her, and he dreams of battle. An ambitious fellow, after 10 minutes of her, will ask nothing better than to muse all his life away. I don't trust her, Fritz. I wish the night were dark."
"What will she do to Rudolf Rassendyll?" I asked, falling in with the old fellow's whimsical mood. "He will see the Queen's face in hers," cried Bernenstein.
"He may see God's," said Sapt,
and he shook himself as though an unwelcome thought had found its way to his mind and lips. A pause fell on us, born of the Colonel's last remark. We looked one another in the face. At last, Sapt brought his hand down on the table with a bang.
"I'll not go back,"
he said sullenly, almost fiercely. "Nor I," said Bernenstein, drawing himself up.
"Nor you, Tarlenheim?"
"No, I also go on," I answered. Then again there was a moment's silence.
"She may make a man soft as a sponge," reflected Sapt, starting again, "or hard as a bar of steel. I should feel safer if the night were dark. I've looked at her often from my tent and from bare ground, and I know her. She got me a decoration, and once she came near to making me turn tail. I have nothing to do with her, young Bernenstein."
"I'll keep my eyes for beauties nearer at hand," said Bernenstein, whose volatile temper soon threw off a serious mood.
"There's a chance for you, now Rupert of Hentzau's gone," said Sapt grimly.
As he spoke, there was a knock at the door. When it opened, James entered. "The Count of Lutzau-Rischenheim begs to be allowed to speak with the King," said James.
"We expect His Majesty every moment. Beg the Count to enter," Sapt answered.
And when Rischenheim came in, he went on, motioning the Count to a chair.
"We are talking, my lord, of the influence of the moon on the careers of men."
"What are you going to do? What have you decided?" burst out Rischenheim impatiently.
"We decide nothing," answered Sapt.
Then what has the king decided?
The king decides nothing, my lord. She decides.
And the old fellow pointed again through the window towards the moon.
At this moment she makes or unmakes a king, but I can't tell you which. What of your cousin?
You know that my cousin's dead.
Yes, I know that. What of him, though?
Sir, said Rischenheim, with some dignity, since he is dead, let him rest in peace. It is not for us to judge him.
He may well wish it were, for by heaven I believe I should let the rogue off, said Colonel Sapt, and I don't think his judge will.
God forgive him, I loved him, said Rischenheim. Yes, and many have loved him. His servants loved him, sir.
Friend Bauer, for example?
Yes, Bauer loved him. Where is Bauer?
I hope he's gone to hell with his loved master, grunted Sapt,
but he had the grace to lower his voice and shield his mouth with his hand, so that Rischenheim did not hear.
We don't know where he is, I answered. I am come, said Rischenheim, to put my services in all respects at the Queen's disposal.
And at the King's?
Asked Sapt. At the King's, but the King is dead.
Therefore, long live the King, struck in young Bernenstein. If there should be a King, began Sapt.
You'll do that? Interrupted Rischenheim in breathless agitation.
She's deciding, said Colonel Sapt,
and again he pointed to the moon. But she's a plaguey long time about it, remarked Lieutenant von Bernenstein. Rischenheim sat silent for a moment. His face was pale, and when he spoke his voice trembled, but his words were resolute enough.
I gave my honour to the Queen, and even in that I will serve her if she commands me.
Bernenstein sprang forward and caught him by the hand. That's what I like, said he, and damn the moon, Colonel. His sentence was hardly out of his mouth when the door opened, and to our astonishment the Queen entered. Helga was just behind her. Her clasped hands and frightened eyes seemed to protest that their coming was against her will. The Queen was clad in a long white robe, and her hair hung on her shoulders, being but loosely bound with a ribbon. Her air showed great agitation, and without any greeting or notice of the rest, she walked quickly across the room to me.
"The dream, Fritz," she said. "It has come again. Helga persuaded me to lie down, and I was very tired, so at last I fell asleep. Then it came. I saw him, Fritz. I saw him as plainly as I see you. They all called him king, as they did today, but they did not cheer. They were quiet, and looked at him with sad faces. I could not hear what they said. They spoke in hushed voices. I heard nothing more than the king, the king. And he seemed to hear not even that. He lay still. He was lying on something covered with hanging stuff. I couldn't see what it was. Yes, quite still. His face was so pale, and he didn't hear them say, the king. Fritz, Fritz, he looked as if he were dead. Where is he? Where have you let him go?
She turned from me, and her eyes flashed over the rest.
Where is he? Why aren't you with him? She demanded,
with a sudden change of tone.
Why aren't you round him? You should be between him and danger, ready to give your lives for his. Indeed, gentlemen, you take your duty lightly.
It might be that there was little reason in her words. There appeared to be no danger threatening him, and after all he was not our king, much as we desired to make him such. Yet we did not think of any such matter. We were abashed before her reproof, and took her indignation as deserved. We hung our heads, and Sapt's shame betrayed itself in the dogged sullenness of his answer.
"He has chosen to go walking, madam, and to go alone. He ordered us, I say he ordered us, not to come. Surely we're right to obey him."
The sarcastic inflection of his voice conveyed his opinion of the Queen's extravagance.
Obey him? Yes, you couldn't go with him if he forbade you, but you should follow him, you should keep him in sight.
This much she spoke in proud tones and with a disdainful manner, but then came a sudden return to her former bearing. She held out her hands towards me, wailing,
Fritz, where is he? Is he safe? Find him for me, Fritz, find him.
I'll find him for you if he's above ground, madam, I cried, for her appeal touched me to the heart.
He's no further off than the gardens, grumbled old Sapt, still resentful of the Queen's reproof and scornful of the woman's agitation.
He was also out of temper with Rudolf himself, because the moon took so long in deciding whether she would make or unmake a king.
"The gardens!" she cried. "Then let us look for him. Oh, you've let him walk in the gardens alone?"
"What should harm the fellow?"
muttered Sapt. She did not hear him, for she had swept out of the room. Helga went with her, and we all followed, Sapt behind the rest of us, still very surly. I heard him grumbling away as we ran downstairs, and having passed along the great corridor, came to the small saloon that opened on the gardens. There were no servants about, but we encountered a night watchman, and Bernenstein snatched the lantern from the astonished man's hand. Save for the dim light thus furnished, the room was dark, but outside the windows the moon streamed brightly down on the broad gravel walk, on the formal flower-beds and the great trees in the gardens. The Queen made straight for the window. I followed her, and having flung the window open, stood by her. The air was sweet, and the breeze struck with grateful coolness on my face. I saw that Sapt had come near, and stood on the other side of the Queen. My wife and the others were behind, looking out where our shoulders left space. There, in the bright moonlight, on the far side of the broad terrace, close by the line of tall trees that fringed its edge, we saw Rudolf Rassendyll, pacing slowly up and down, with his hands behind his back, and his eyes fixed on the arbiter of his fate, on her who was to make him a king, or send him a fugitive from Strelsau.
"There he is, madam," said Sapt. "Safe enough."
The Queen did not answer. Sapt said no more, and of the rest none of us spoke. We stood watching him as he struggled with his great issue. A greater surely has seldom fallen to the lot of any man born in a private station. Yet I could read little of it on the face that the rays of white light displayed so clearly, although they turned his healthy tints to a dull grey, and gave unnatural sharpness to his features against the deep background of black foliage. I heard the Queen's quick breathing, but there was scarcely another sound. I saw her clutch her gown and pull it away a little from her throat. Save for that, none in the group moved. The lantern's light was too dim to force notice from Mr. Rassendyll. Unconscious of our presence, he wrestled with fate that night in the gardens. Suddenly, the faintest exclamation came from Sapt. He put his hand back and beckoned to Bernenstein. The young man handed his lantern to the constable, who set it close to the side of the window frame. The Queen, absolutely engrossed in her lover, saw nothing, but I perceived what had caught Sapt's attention. There were scores on the paint and indentations in the wood, just at the edge of the panel and near the lock. I glanced at Sapt, who nodded his head. It looked very much as though somebody had tried to force the door that night, employing a knife which had dented the woodwork and scratched the paint. The least thing was enough to alarm us, standing where we stood, and the constable's face was full of suspicion. Who had sought an entrance? It could be no trained and practised housebreaker. He would have had better tools. But now our attention was again diverted. Rudolf stopped short. He still looked for a moment at the sky. Then his glance dropped to the ground at his feet. A second later he jerked his head. It was bare, and I saw the dark red hair stir with the movement, like a man who has settled something which caused him a puzzle. In an instant we knew, by the quick intuition of contagious emotion, that the question had found its answer. He was, by now, king or fugitive. The Lady of the Skies had given her decision. The thrill ran through us. I felt the Queen draw herself together at my side. I felt the muscles of Rischenheim's arm, which rested against my shoulder, grow rigid and taut. Sapt's face was full of eagerness, and he gnawed his moustache silently. We gathered closer to one another. At last we could bear the suspense no longer. With one look at the Queen and another at me, Sapt stepped onto the gravel. He would go and learn the answer. Thus the unendurable strain that had stretched us like tortured men on a rack would be relieved. The Queen did not answer his glance, nor even seem to see that he had moved. Her eyes were still all for Mr. Rassendyll,
her thoughts buried in his, for her happiness was in his hands, and lay poised on the issue of that decision whose momentousness held him for a moment motionless on the path. Often I seemed to see him as he stood there, tall, straight, and stately, the king a man's fancy paints when he reads of great monarchs who flourished long ago in the springtime of the world. Zapt's step crunched on the gravel. Rudolf heard it and turned his head. He saw Zapt, and he saw me also behind Zapt. He smiled, composedly and brightly, but he did not move from where he was. He held out both hands towards the constable, and caught him in their double grasp, still smiling down in his face. I was no nearer to reading his decision, though I saw that he had reached a resolution that was immovable, and gave peace to his soul. If he meant to go on, he would go on now, on to the end, without a backward look or a falter of his foot. If he had chosen the other way, he would depart without a murmur or a hesitation. The Queen's quick breathing had ceased. She seemed like a statue, but Rischenheim moved impatiently, as though he could no longer endure the waiting. Zapt's voice came harsh and grating.
"Well," he cried, "which is it to be? Backward or forward?"
Rudolf pressed his hands and looked into his eyes. The answer asked but a word from him. The Queen caught my arm. Her rigid limbs seemed to give way, and she would have fallen if I had not supported her. At the same instant a man sprang out of the dark line of tall trees directly behind Mr. Rassendyll. Bernenstein uttered a loud, startled cry and rushed forward, pushing the Queen herself violently out of his path. His hand flew to his side, and he ripped the heavy cavalry sword that belonged to his uniform of the cuirassiers of the guard from its sheath. I saw it flash in the moonlight, but its flash was quenched in a brighter, short blaze. A shot rang out through the quiet gardens. Mr. Rassendyll did not loose his hold of Zapt's hands, but he sank slowly onto his knees. Zapt seemed paralysed. Again Bernenstein cried out. It was a name this time. "Bauer! By God, Bauer!" he cried. In an instant he was across the path and by the trees. The assassin fired again, but now he missed. We saw the great sword flash high above Bernenstein's head and heard it whistle through the air. It crashed on the crown of Bauer's head, and he fell like a log to the ground with his skull split. The Queen's hold on me relaxed. She sank into Rischenheim's arms. I ran forward and knelt by Mr. Rassendyll. He still held Zapt's hands, and by their help buoyed himself up. But when he saw me, he let go of them, and sank back against me, his head resting on my chest. He moved his lips, but seemed unable to speak. He was shot through the back. Bauer had avenged the master whom he loved, and was gone to meet him. There was a sudden stir from inside the palace. Shutters were flung back, and windows thrown open. The group we made stood clean-cut, plainly visible in the moonlight. A moment later there was a rush of eager feet, and we were surrounded by officers and servants. Bernenstein stood by me now, leaning on his sword. Zapt had not uttered a word. His face was distorted with horror and bitterness. Rudolf's eyes were closed, and his head lay back against me. "A man has shot the king," said I, in bald, stupid explanation. All at once I found James, Mr. Rassendyll's servant, by me. "I have sent for doctors, my lord," he said. "Come, let us carry him in." He, Zapt, and I lifted Rudolf, and bore him across the gravel terrace and into the little saloon. We passed the Queen. She was leaning on Rischenheim's arm and held my wife's hand. We laid Rudolf down on a couch. Outside I heard Bernenstein say, "Pick up that fellow and carry him somewhere out of sight." Then he also came in, followed by a crowd. He sent them all to the door, and we were left alone, waiting for the surgeon. The Queen came up, Rischenheim still supporting her.
"Rudolf! Rudolf!"
she whispered, very softly. He opened his eyes, and his lips bent in a smile. She flung herself on her knees and kissed his hand passionately. "The surgeon will be here directly," said I. Rudolf's eyes had been on the Queen. As I spoke, he looked up at me, smiled again, and shook his head. I turned away. When the surgeon came, Zapt and I assisted him in his examination. The Queen had been led away, and we were alone. The examination was very short. Then we carried Rudolf to a bed. The nearest chanced to be in Bernenstein's room. There we laid him, and there all that could be done for him was done. All this time we had asked no questions of the surgeon, and he had given no information. We knew too well to ask. We had all seen men die before now, and the look on the face was familiar to us. Two or three more doctors, the most eminent in Strelsau, came now, having been hastily summoned. It was their right to be called, but for all the good they were, they might have been left to sleep the night out in their beds. They drew together in a little group at the end of the room, and talked for a few minutes in low tones. James lifted his master's head and gave him a drink of water. Rudolf swallowed it with difficulty. Then I saw him feebly press James's hand, for the little man's face was full of sorrow. As his master smiled, the servant mustered a smile in answer. I crossed over to the doctors. "Well, gentlemen?" I asked. They looked at one another. Then the greatest of them said gravely, "The king may live an hour. Count Fritz, should you not send for a priest?" I went straight back to Rudolf Rassendyll. His eyes greeted me and questioned me. He was a man, and I played no silly tricks with him. I bent down and said, "An hour, they think, Rudolf." He made one restless movement, whether of pain or protest I do not know. Then he spoke, very low, slowly, and with difficulty. "Then they can go," he said. And when I spoke of a priest, he shook his head. I went back to them and asked if anything more could be done. The answer was nothing. But I could not prevail further than to get all save one sent into an adjoining room. He who remained seated himself at a table some way off. Rudolf's eyes had closed again. Old Sapt, who had not once spoken since the shot was fired, raised a haggard face to mine.
"We'd better fetch her to him," he said hoarsely.
I nodded my head. Sapt went while I stayed by him. Bernenstein came to him, bent down, and kissed his hand. The young fellow who had borne himself with such reckless courage and dash throughout the affair was quite unmanned now, and the tears were rolling down his face. I could have been in much the same plight, but I would not before Mr. Rassendyll. He smiled at Bernenstein. Then he said to me,
"Is she coming, Fritz?"
"Yes, she's coming, sire," I answered. He noticed the style of my address. A faint, amused gleam shot into his languid eyes.
"Well, for an hour, then," he murmured, and lay back on his pillows.
She came, dry-eyed, calm and queenly. We all drew back, and she knelt down by his bed, holding his hand in her two hands. Presently the hand stirred. She let it go. Then, knowing well what he wanted, she raised it herself, and placed it on her head, while she bowed her face to the bed. His hand wandered for the last time over the gleaming hair that he had loved so well. She rose, passed her arm about his shoulders, and kissed his lips. Her face rested close to his, and he seemed to speak to her, but we could not have heard the words, even if we would. So they remained for a long while. The doctor came and felt his pulse, retreating afterwards with close-shut lips. We drew a little nearer, for we knew that he would not be long with us now. Suddenly strength seemed to come upon him. He raised himself in his bed and spoke in distinct tones. "God has decided," he said. "I've tried to do the right thing through it all. Sapt and Bernenstein and you, old Fritz, shake my hand. No, don't kiss it. We've done with pretense now." We shook his hand as he bade us. Then he took the Queen's hand. Again she knew his mind and moved it to his lips. "In life and in death, my sweet Queen," he murmured. And thus he fell asleep. End of chapter 20. Chapter 21 of Rupert of Hentzau. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please go to LibriVox.org. Recording by Andy Minter. Rupert of Hentzau. Taken from the memoirs of Fritz von Tarlenheim. By Anthony Hope. Chapter 21. The Coming of the Dream. There is little need, and I have little heart, to dwell on what followed the death of Mr. Rassendyll. The plans we had laid to secure his tenure of the throne, in case he had accepted it, served well in the event of his death. Bower's lips were for ever sealed. The old woman was too scared and appalled to hint even to her gossips of the suspicions she entertained. Rischenheim was loyal to the pledge he had given to the Queen. The ashes of the hunting lodge held their secret fast, and none suspected when the charred body which was called Rudolf Rassendyll's was laid to quiet rest in the graveyard of the town of Zenda, hard by the tomb of Herbert the Forester, for we had from the first rejected any idea of bringing the King's body to Strelsau and setting it in the place of Mr. Rassendyll's. The difficulties of such an undertaking were almost insuperable. In our hearts we did not desire to conquer them. As a king, Rudolf Rassendyll had died. As a king, let him lie. As a king, he lay in his palace at Strelsau, while the news of his murder at the hands of a confederate of Rupert of Hentzau went forth to startle and appall the world. At a mighty price our task had been made easy. Many might have doubted the living, none questioned the dead. Suspicions which might have gathered round a throne died away at the gate of a vault. The king was dead. Who would ask if it were in truth the king who lay in state in the great hall of the palace, or whether the humble grave at Zenda held the bones of the last male Elfberg? In the silence of the grave all murmurs and questionings were hushed. Throughout the day people had been passing and repassing through the great hall. There, on a stately bier surmounted by a crown and the drooping folds of the royal banner, lay Rudolf Rassendyll. The highest officer guarded him. In the cathedral, the archbishop said a mass for his soul. He had lain there 3 days. The evening of the third had come, and early on the morrow he was to be buried. There is a little gallery in the hall that looks down on the spot where the bier stood. Here was I on this evening, and with me Queen Flavia. We were alone together, and together we saw beneath us the calm face of the dead man. He was clad in the white uniform in which he had been crowned. The ribbon of the red rose was across his breast. His hand held a true red rose, fresh and fragrant. Flavia herself had set it there, that even in death he might not miss the chosen token of her love. I had not spoken to her, nor she to me, since we came there. We watched the pomp round him, and the circles of people that came to bring a wreath for him, or to look upon his face. I saw a girl come and kneel long at the bier's foot. She rose and went away sobbing, leaving a little circlet of flowers. It was Rosa Hulf. I saw women come and go weeping, and men bite their lips as they passed by. Rischenheim came, pale-faced and troubled, and while all came and went, there, immovable, with drawn sword in military stiffness, old Sapt stood at the head of the bier, his eyes set steadily in front of him, and his body never stirring from hour to hour through the long day. A distant faint hum of voices reached us. The Queen laid her hand on my arm. "It's the dream, Fritz," she said. "Hark! They speak of the King. They speak in low voices and with grief, but they call him King. It's what I saw in the dream, but he does not hear nor heed. No, he can't hear nor heed, even when I call him my King." A sudden impulse came on me, and I turned to her, asking, "What had he decided, madam? Would he have been king?" She started a little. "He didn't tell me," she answered, "and I didn't think of it while he spoke to me." "Of what, then, did he speak, madam?" "Only of his love, of nothing but his love, Fritz," she answered. "Well, I take it that when a man comes to die, love is more to him than a kingdom. It may be, if we could see truly, that it is more to him, even while he lives. "Of nothing but his great love for me, Fritz," she said again. "And my love brought him to his death." "He wouldn't have had it otherwise," said I. "No," she whispered, and she leant over the parapet of the gallery, stretching out her arms to him. But he lay still and quiet, not hearing and not heeding what she murmured. "My king, my king!" It was even as it had been in the dream. That night James, the servant, took leave of his dead master and of us. He carried to England, by word of mouth, for we dared write nothing down, the truth concerning the King of Ruritania and Mr. Rassendyll. It was to be told to the Earl of Burlesdon, Rudolf's brother, under a pledge of secrecy, and to this day the Earl is the only man besides ourselves who knows the story. His errand done, James returned in order to enter the Queen's service, in which he still is, and he told us that when Lord Burlesdon had heard the story, he sat silent for a great while, and then said, "He did well. Some day I will visit his grave. Tell Her Majesty that there is still a Rassendyll if she has need of one." The offer was such as should come from a man of Rudolf's name, yet I trust that the Queen needs no further service than such as it is our humble duty and dear delight to render her. It is our part to strive to lighten the burden that she bears, and by our love to assuage her undying grief, for she reigns now in Ruritania alone, the last of all the Elfbergs, and her only joy is to talk of Mr. Rassendyll with those few who knew him, her only hope that she may some day be with him again. In great pomp we laid him to his rest in the vault of the kings of Ruritania in the Cathedral of Strelsau. There he lies among the princes of the House of Elfberg. I think that if there be indeed any consciousness above the dead, or any knowledge of what passes in the world they have left, they should be proud to call him brother. There rises in memory of him a stately monument, and people point it out to one another as the memorial of King Rudolf. I often go to the spot, and recall in thought all that passed when he came the first time to Zenda, and again on his second coming, for I mourn him as a man mourns a trusted leader and a loved comrade, and I should have asked no better than to be allowed to serve him all my days. Yet I serve the Queen, and in that I do most truly serve her lover. Times change for all of us. The roaring flood of youth goes by, and the stream of life sinks to a quiet flow. Sapt is an old man now. Soon my sons will be grown up, men enough themselves to serve Queen Flavia. Yet the memory of Rudolf Rassendyll is fresh to me as on the day he died, and the vision of the death of Rupert of Hentzau dances often before my eyes. It may be that some day the whole story shall be told, and men shall judge of it for themselves. To me it seems now as though all had ended well.
I must not be misunderstood.
My heart is still sore for the loss of him, but we saved the Queen's fair name, and to Rudolf himself the fatal stroke came as a relief from a choice too difficult. On the one side lay what impaired his own honour, on the other what threatened hers. As I think on this, my anger at his death is less, though my grief cannot be. To this day I know not how he chose, no, and I don't know how he should have chosen. Yet he had chosen, for his face was calm and clear. Come, I have thought so much of him that I will go now and stand before his monument, taking with me my last-born son, a little lad of 10. He is not too young to desire to serve the Queen, and not too young to learn to love and reverence him who sleeps there in the vault, and was in his life the noblest gentleman I have known. I will take the boy with me, and tell him what I may of brave King Rudolf, how he fought, and how he loved, and how he held the Queen's honour and his own above all things in this world. The boy is not too young to learn such lessons from the life of Mr. Rassendyll. And while we stand there, I will turn again into his native tongue, for, alas, the young rogue loves his toy soldiers better than his Latin. The inscription that the Queen wrote with her own hand, directing that it should be inscribed in that stately tongue over the tomb in which her life lies buried. To Rudolf, who reigned lately in this city, and reigns for ever in her heart, Queen Flavia. I told him the meaning, and he spelt the big words over in his childish voice. At first he stumbled, but the second time he had it right, and recited with a little touch of awe in his fresh young tones, "Rudolfo, qui in hac civitate nuper regnavit, in corde ipsius in eternam regnat, Flavia Regina." I felt his hand tremble in mine, and he looked up in my face. "God save the Queen, Father," said he. End of chapter 21, and end of Rupert of Hentzau, by Anthony Hope. Read by Andy Minter.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.